And Scott Stewart is in the studio with me. He's got a stack of music that was written for movies, but borrowed from other composers. These stories and more today on City Lights.
Support for WABE comes from Wells Fargo. Because Wells Fargo Advisors has an understanding of what went into building wealth, they'll help you manage it with the care it deserves. You can learn more at wellsfargo.com/yourwealth. And from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, presenting opening night of the 71st season with Mahler's Second Symphony, Thursday, September 17th at 8 p.m. in Atlanta Symphony Hall. Tickets at atlantasymphony.org or 404-733-5000. Classical series presented by Delta Airlines.
Today, we are making our own sequel with part two of The Art of Musical Borrowing, how master composers sculpt and mold pre-existing musical ideas to form their own new music, both for film and concert. We're in the studio with Dr. Scott Stewart, film music commentator, WABE friend, Great Rights' friend, and host of WABE's Strike Up the Band here on WABE. Welcome back, Scott.
Hey, thanks, Lois. It's great to be here. When last we left off with our heroes, and I guess that's us, we were extolling the virtues of what amounts to musical recycling, and that is the purposeful reuse of pre-existing music as the basis for new compositions, both for the movies and for concert halls. There are some critics who are prone to level charges of stealing or lifting or plagiarizing, but my position is that all music came from somewhere, and a lot of clever composers find lots of different ways to rework and recreate musical ideas in a very general way, gestures, and sometimes even full-blown melodies that they use in soundtracks and in concert music.
So it's not fair to say something is derivative.
I don't think so, especially if they're reusing it, reworking it for their own purposes in drama and narrative.
And in a way that makes it intrinsically the next composer's own. Well, this applies to composers over centuries of music writing. But we're giving some special attention to perhaps the most influential and most successful film composer in history, that is to say, John Williams.
I think John Williams is in that specific category. His career started back in the 50s in television work, and now he's 83 this year, and he is full steam ahead, working in post-production now with Star Wars 7, The Force Awakens, which comes out in December. Steven Spielberg has also harangued him for two other productions. One is the BFG, that's The Big Friendly Giant, which comes out in 16. And then he is also slated in Film Score Monthly Online to score the fifth Indiana Jones movie. And we're not sure when that exactly is coming out, but most guesses are around 2018. Steven Spielberg has very graciously and humbly and publicly credited John Williams not only for the success of a lot of his movies, but really for his entire career.
Wow. Well, this brings up an interesting point because, as we've discussed, Scott, there are well-known director-composer pairings in film music history. Alfred Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann, Christopher Nolan and Hans Zimmer, Tim Burton and Danny Elfman. Two of my favorites, Nina Rota and Francis Ford Coppola and Ennio Morricone and Sergio Leone. Those are just a
great pairings.
Few,
yeah.
A few. And I know you like Howard Shore and Peter Jackson as well. Film and TV composing is more of a team effort than, obviously, when writing for symphony orchestra or a wind ensemble or chorus or chamber music or keyboard or concert.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to for all of us to imagine that when the composer gets what we call the rough cut of the movie, and that's the film without the sound in it, sometimes a little bit of dialogue, that the composer just writes the soundtrack and then turns it back in and it's all done. In fact, it doesn't really work like that at all. There's this group that gets together. These are movie executives that are could be the producer, the director, the composer, the orchestrators, the sound editors. Then they get together in what's called a spotting session.
Oh, dear. Is this like that definition of a camel?
What's that?
It's a horse invented by a committee.
Oh, yes, it's kind of like that.
Okay.
Where everybody is unhappy about the decision, but it's something everyone can live with. That's what my definition of a faculty meeting. So in the spotting session, everybody decides, and of course the director is leading the charge here, where music is going to be in the movie, where it comes in, where it exits, if it's big or if it's small or if it's prominent or if it's in the background. And then the composer is given marching orders. And of course you can imagine nowadays we have the digital counter on the lower left corner of the screen. Mm. And sometimes the director will just say, okay, between 7:09 and 7:11, we need something dramatic.
Wow.
And then we need silence between. So it can be a very, very specific set of instructions.
What's the timeline like at that point?
This can vary depending on how much music they want, but the average would be around 6 to 8 weeks. So it's a really quick turnaround. And remember, that includes composing the soundtrack, having it orchestrated, having it rehearsed, and having it recorded so that the sound editors can get it put into the film.
I imagine that members of the spotting session team could have anywhere from zero, maybe that would be the producer, to a lot of knowledge about music.
And I'm sure that is a sore spot for many composers. If someone doesn't quite have as much musical background as the composer obviously does when making decisions about music.
Kind of like the emperor telling Mozart too many notes.
Yep, that's it. It's very important to remember that the director has the final say and the vision about the entire film. So as important as music is to us as musicians, it's only one piece of the pie in the whole big picture. And so the composer has to play ball. And so if a composer says, you know, when they hear part of the soundtrack, well, no, that doesn't work. It's not funny enough. Make it funnier. You can either, as the composer, go stomping indignantly off into the sunset and say, well, or you can say, no problem. Mm-hmm. We'll add a slide trombone and a xylophone, and now it's funny. So the composers that keep jobs are the ones who play well in the sandbox.
And also give us memorable scores.
That's right.
So it makes sense that a composer like John Williams would have lots of tools in his composer toolbox, including pre-existing music to rework in a hurry if it's needed.
Right. So you just imagine if a director said, we need something different, you would go to the melody toolbox, the harmony toolbox, the rhythm, the form, the instrumentation toolbox, and start pulling out stuff. And of course, some of it's going to be stuff that you already know. Sometimes I play this clip for students or audiences and see if they recognize it.
I bet I can guess what they think it is.
And if you're thinking that they respond the theme from Jaws, you're right.
Before Dvorak.
Yeah. But in fact, thousands of times on WABE classical programs, we've heard the opening to the fourth movement of Antonin Dvorak's Symphony No. 9. This is the symphony from the New World. And so that little, the little half step that John Williams uses in Jaws is the same interval. Dvorak uses it to build suspense. In the opening of his finale, John Williams uses it to build suspense as a shark is coming at you. Same basic technique, same melodic interval, but written about 84 years apart.
Okay. Other than the interval, do you, Scott Stewart, doctorate from Indiana University, do you think that John Williams had Dvorak in his mind here?
No, I don't think so. But I think he knew that the half step, creates tension. And I think there's something really dramatic about that. Now, I still think it could qualify as musical borrowing. So, and he would have known Dvorak's New World Symphony when he was a young composer. So the charge of stealing or lifting is not accurate, I don't think. But I think if he had knowledge of that, sure, he may have borrowed that and said, what's a great way to make audiences kind of sit on the edges of their seats? Use that interval. Of course, now anytime you hear that interval, you're thinking shark.
Not Dvorak.
That's right.
Dvorak.
That's right.
That's how you say it.
And of course, one of his tried and true methods of creating suspense is to use this ostinato. And this is this repeated rhythmic pattern that pounds away underneath while there's something else going up on top. Let's take a listen to the Imperial Attack. This is after the opening crawl of the first Star Wars movie in 1977. So we have that underlying rhythm in the cellos and the basses and the timpani and that imperial motif that's occurring on top with the horns and later in the upper strings. And this is exciting and clearly leading us forward dramatically.
And it also sounds like John Williams may be drawing inspiration from one of the great space soundtracks of all time. The Planets by Gustav Holst.
Oh, there is no question about this. John Williams has stated on many occasions that he was very heavily influenced by Gustav Holst's The Planets when he was a young man. And we know that George Lucas used classical music by Holst and Tchaikovsky and Dvorak and others in his temp tracks when he was trying to get a feel for how those scenes would play out in the theater. There's a massive ostinato section from Mars in The Planets that is one of the great moments in all of classical music.
Okay, so this John Williams is not a quote, but something more like written in the spirit of The Planets.
Right. I think of this as stylistic allusions where John Williams is channeling the vibe of Gustav Holst using an ostinato underneath to build tension. And later in after the battle sequence at the opening of Star Wars, we hear what I would consider to be a little bit more direct tip of the hat. This is Rebel Blockade Runner. And so we can compare that back to back very quickly with the ending of Mars by Holst. And so here, the chord structure, the instrumentation, I think even the key is the same, and that really plodding rhythm, I think have a little too much in common to be coincidence. But it works beautifully in The Planets, and it works beautifully when Williams uses it in Star Wars.
And in the opening of Spaceballs, seriously, because that itself is a very funny riff on the
classic
space music with, you know, the long ago in a galaxy.
It's
is that
right there.
Williams or Holst?
Spaceballs is its own category. We may have to devote an entire segment to it's amazing how Spaceballs works its way into almost every segment we do, Lois.
It's phenomenal. Citizen Kane, the bicycle thief, it's up there. All right. John Williams didn't write the famous Imperial March until the first sequel, The Empire Strikes Back. But we keep hearing that imperial motive. I don't want to think John Williams is an imperialist.
Not at
John.
All. He's using this little da-da-dum, da-da-dum, that little minor third, the descending melodic fragment, in many different ways. And I accidentally stumbled upon this when I was rewatching Disney's Fantasia.
Can see Mickey in the marching water buckets. By the way, I have to tell you, listeners, this is the God's honest truth. I watched Muppets Take Manhattan last night.
Last night? Yeah.
Yes. Fabulous.
This is one of the great visualizations of classical music. So Mickey Mouse is the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and of course, this is the great tone poem by French composer Paul Dukas.
Oui.
So we hear that motif, that di-di-dum, over and over again. Dukas uses it more as a finishing touch or a bookend. John Williams uses it as kind of a primary signal that we're dealing with the bad guys. And toward the very end of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, we hear it one more time in an even more pronounced way. So is this lifting or stealing? It's the same melodic interval. Mm-hmm. It's harmonized similarly. I still say no. I think it's borrowed. I think it would be hard to stake a claim on those two little notes. But if anything, it's a salute to Paul Dukas for coming up with such an effective and simple dramatic device in this tone poem, which then John Williams could rework in the Star Wars episode.
Mm. Well, one of the most inspiring moments in all of the Star Wars movies is when Luke Skywalker is contemplating his future, or perhaps a lack
yes.
of one, when he goes outside his desert home to gaze upon the double sunset.
Yes, his home planet of Tatooine has two suns, much like Atlanta feels like here in the summer. And this cue is entitled Binary Sunset / the Force theme. So it's one of the first appearances of this really gorgeous melody that we associate with the Force and with the Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi.
He's quoting himself, isn't he?
He is quoting himself. So we hear that little Star Wars main theme, which is Luke's theme, played gently in the flute and the clarinet. This is such a remarkable scene because there's nothing going on. It's Luke standing, looking at two suns, and that's about it. But we learn so much about his hopes and aspirations with this gigantic horn solo followed by this swell in the orchestra, and this takes us right back to the 1930s soundtracks of Eric Korngold and Max Steiner. For me, this is one of the most powerful moments in all of film music, and some would say this is the moment that the symphonic soundtrack from the 1930s returned to kind of full circle in the 1970s.
Now, you were toddling, but I was actually in the Von Lee Theater in Bloomington
yeah.
when Star Wars, when the original came out in 1977. And there's a Regal scene at the end of Star Wars 4 from 1977, in which our heroes are welcomed. I should add for you listeners who may not know that Bloomington, Indiana has a university that has, well, now what, 40,000 mm-hmm. students or so, many of them music geeks. And all of those music geeks filled this audience for Star Wars, and they were talking about the Williams music as the film was being screened. John Williams again recycles some of his own character themes in this Star Wars 4, reverting back to 77, he presents them in new clothes.
Yeah, he does. And this is a really iconic scene in all of the Star Wars trilogy. At the end of Episode 4, A New Hope, Princess Leia decorates Luke and Han Solo and Chewbacca for their heroic deeds in destroying the Death Star. And they enter this large hall and process up the aisle to a fanfare and then some other familiar music that we've heard before.
So we're experiencing a kind of pastiche of both the Force theme and other snippets from the main Star Wars title music. And dare I say, as everyone was screaming in Bloomington, it sure sounds like Wagner.
It does sound like Wagner. It's just gigantic brass with rhythmic underpinning. It's so beautiful. All the great composers do this. They recycle their own stuff. So we hear now the Obi-Wan Kenobi, the Force theme that we just heard with the Binary Sunset. Now it's in a minor key, and it's being blared out by trumpets. And later we hear the bridge of the Star Wars theme all combined into this kind of throne room processional.
So where is John Williams drawing this throne room processional music from?
I think in this case, it's modeled after the basic procedures and musical operations of some English coronation marches. And there are a whole bunch of these. We know the Pomp and Circumstance marches by Edward Elgar. And the one I'm thinking of that's kind of a close match in feel is the Crown Imperial Coronation March by William Walton.
So we really are talking imperialism.
We are?
It is impeccably British. Those English marches are in no hurry at all.
They aren't.
And there also seems to be no hurry in the span of time between the original trilogy and the prequels, which came 20, 21 years mm-hmm. later?
We grew up with the Star Wars movies, 77 through 83. The prequels released in 2001 to 2005. So essentially, there's an entire generation that had passed between those two sets of movies. And music became one of the primary unifiers of the entire series. And I think in a stroke of genius on John Williams's part, he assigned the young Anakin Skywalker his own sweet little tender tune with one crucial piece of information added to reveal his true future identity.
Thank you.
This is a very super cool inside joke, since all of us know that someday Anakin Skywalker will grow up to be supervillain Darth Vader, and the closing melodic sequence of this very childlike tune is also the ending portion of the dreaded Imperial March, which is played at every basketball game in America, the musical theme that's assigned to Darth Vader, beginning with The Empire Strikes Back. I did stumble upon, Lois,
yes,
one other instance of potentially more deliberate musical borrowing. Here is the finale of a nice little piano trio by Antonin Dvorak. This is the one in E minor subtitled The Dumpke Trio.
Dvorak, call home. It sounds beautifully with the Ozark Trio or on a bicycle flying over the moon.
It's great stuff.
Scott Stewart, you are such an inspiration. Oh, my goodness. To be one of your students, to be your friend, to be a listener at WABE, may our franchise never end.
More sequels to come. Thanks, Lois.
Thank you so much. This is City Lights on WABE Atlanta.